But what happened then? Dumped corn on the market, which forced the price down.
See, now you're going.
There you're going.
What's going on here?
See?
Yeah, now shut it off so I don't...
What's this, see?
Yeah.
Now, we're talking about the feud between Hillman, between Murray and Hillman.
I don't recall too much of it, but the thing brought out dramatically, I thought, was at a meeting that was held at Gifford Pinchot's home, Governor Pinchot.
Now, there were several meetings there, weren't
yeah.
there?
Yes.
It was, this one was when Patton brought up the, yeah. the question, and Patton got drunk also a little
later. That's right, that's the one.
And you probed him as to what this was all about?
Yeah.
Was this the meeting when Patton said to you that, Phil was tired of having a back seat?
That's right.
And now Pinchot went along on this thing, didn't he?
Yeah,
foreman?
That's right.
Didn't they want Pinchot to be chairman?
They wanted, I don't know as they got as far as naming a chairman of CIO PAC, but they wanted to move the...
now this was CIO PAC.
The CIO PAC.
Yeah. This wasn't NC PAC.
No, this was CIO PAC they were talking about. No, the matter of NC PAC never came up, as far as I know, not in my presence.
Well, now, how did you happen to be? You weren't a director on CIO.
No, but most of these people, practically all the people at this meeting at Pinchot's home, were NCP people. They weren't CIO PAC men. They were.
How did that happen? And they were discussing CIO PAC.
I don't know.
You
were
a CIO.
No, not I don't. I think Phil was the only one that was. Because there was Governor Pinchot, and there's Louis Wise, there's Clark Foreman, Jim Patton,
John Epp,
Beanie,
yourself,
myself. Raymond Walsh.
Who was Raymond Walsh?
J. Raymond Walsh. He was a professor from came originally from Wisconsin. He was active in NCPAC.
Yeah. And well, now just a moment. How long had you been before this meeting? You don't know how long you'd been associated with NCPAC.
Well, I should think a year or two. I don't know.
Well, you had already made this trip. And you, or did that come later?
That came later.
Yes. So you actually were associated with NCPAC when it first arose.
Well, I think so, as I first.
Well, you were on the first executive board as it came up. Mm-hmm.
I don't recall just when how that developed.
Yeah. Now, right there, before we get out of this, you made this trip with Beanie, beginning, I think, in early July of 45, that will show.
I think that's correct.
Now, I also know that Clinton Anderson took office as Secretary of Agriculture in July of 45. Mm-hmm. One thing I want to know is when was it that you and Beanie paid this visit to Truman?
It was in June.
It was about a month before that. Mm-hmm. And at that time, amongst other things, he said how pleased you were going to be with the people that he was going to name to head agriculture in the Veterans Bureau.
Yeah.
It was just before he named them.
That's right. Just
but he didn't tell you who they were going to be.
He didn't tell us who they were. He said we'd be pleased with their appointment.
All right. Now, while I'm on that same subject, Elmer, you told me before about this, and I've got some notes on it. I have the story pretty well. I have Beanie's story. What had been going on United Nations-wise, or preliminary to United nation is.
Well, there was a, there were a lot of...
The war was not over yet.
No, no. But they were forming the United Nations at San Francisco.
The meetings were already taking place
in San Francisco. Molotov had been there, or was there.
Uh-huh. And, at the time.
And
I can check this in other history sources, mm-hmm. but I want to get your remembrance of it.
He was there, and there were some ugly stories leaking out of San Francisco, newspaper stories.
Do you remember specific ones? Things that caused your concern?
I don't remember exactly what they... There were vicious criticism of the Soviet Union, our principal ally in the war.
Do you remember who made them particularly? Was it Jimmy Burns?
What is the name of the Secretary of State? Stettinius? Or what is it?
Stettinius.
Stettinius was one.
Yeah.
And Harriman was another.
Harriman, the great negotiator.
Yeah, the great negotiator was another. I've forgotten not just who they were, but we were upset about it anyway.
Yeah. And the understanding was that you were going to talk about that, and Beeney was going to go after the local situation.
I think the way when we came in and the president greeted us, well then Beeney said to him, now Elmer's going to outline the program we have in mind, what we expected, what we're thinking about. And after he's through, if he's overlooked anything, well, I'll try to bring it up. So the thing...
That's the procedure.
Yeah, so
you did the main talking, and then Beeney followed
that's
through.
That's the way we planned it.
Yeah.
And the first thing was...
I know the story his greeting you and so forth.
Well, then we said, well, we're terribly concerned about some of these stories that are coming out of San Francisco. And he says, what do you mean, about the Soviet Union? And he says, yes, we do. Well, he said, you want to remember the... we're 150 years old. Great Britain is much older than we are. The Soviet Union's only 25 years old, and they don't know how to behave. They behave like a bull in a china shop, and we've got to put them in their place. Well, I said, well, maybe that is so. But just remember, they're our principal ally in this war, and we've got to learn to get along with them.
Remember you telling me, too, about his thick lenses and his eyes. His eyes see way back.
Yeah, and then he said, well, maybe that's so. And we noticed that a few days later he sent Harry Hopkins over to the Soviet Union, to Moscow. So maybe he was concerned about it after all.
Now, on the executive committee, Elmer, of the NCPAC, it was Verda White Barnes. Who was she?
Well, she was... She worked for the auto workers. She was a member. She's a Mormon from Utah. She's now administrative assistant to United States Senator Church of Idaho.
Oh yes, yes. I believe Orville told me that and suggested I get in touch with her.
Yeah, she's a very brilliant woman.
Now Frieda Kirchway.
She's the was the editor and publisher of New Republic.
James Loeb.
I don't recall who he was.
Lucy Randolph Mason.
I don't recall who she was either.
Jim McGill.
Well, Jim McGill was an industrialist from Valparaiso, Indiana.
Okay. Now a few of the members of the committee that I... let's see. There's a couple of preachers here I was interested in. Who was, do you remember Bishop R.R. Wright, Jr., do you know?
Yes, I think he was I think his church was either the Methodist or the Baptist church. He was a colored man.
Colored man, yeah. Mm-hmm. Who was Dr. James Dombrowski?
He was the secretary of the Southern Conference of, the executive secretary of Southern Conference or something. Let's see.
Yeah, he was a white man.
Yeah, dealing with problems in the South.
Yes, yes. Who was a Dr. Arthur M. Schlesinger?
Dr. Arthur Schlesinger is the now well-known historian and advisor to President Kennedy.
Bishop Francis J. McConnell.
Oh, he was a bishop of
Baptist.
I forgot whether Episcopalian or. Yeah. I think Episcopalian.
Yeah. Judge John Gutnecht.
I don't remember him. But Mrs. Mary McLeod Bethune was a very famous Negro woman. Van Bittner was active in the CIO, yeah. Vice President. Mrs. Emmons Blaine was the daughter of Cyrus McCormick, the inventor of the harvester.
Yeah. One of the good McCormick.
Yeah, she was one of the good ones. And Bruce Blevin, he was with the New Republic, wasn't he, or the Nation, one or the other.
Nation.
And Dr. W. Russell Bowie was a professor of theology at either Yale or Princeton, I've forgotten which. Otto Bremer is a New York, or a Minnesota, a St. Paul banker, and Bremer.
I know him, yes. Know about him.
James Kay, the CIO, you know him.
Right.
Mark Connelly, you know him.
Yep.
Albert Spades Coolidge. Joseph Karen, you know him. Dr. Du Bois is on here. Okay. No, Ben Du Bois. Ben Du Bois is on
here. Not Dr. Du Bois.
No, you know Ben.
Yes, of course.
Ethel DuPont, one of the DuPonts. Here's a couple more DuPonts here. Mrs. Clifford Durr. She's the wife of Cliff Durr, who was chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. And she's a sister-in-law of Justice Hugo Black. Albert Fitzgerald, you know him. Yeah. Clark Foreman, you know him.
Sure.
John Kenneth Galbraith, the...
I think that's probably far enough.
Eleanor Gimbel.
I have said, or am saying, that this membership list is really a who's who of liberalism, prominent liberals in America.
At that time.
At that time.
I certainly am.
Yes.
Yip Harburg's on here, I see. Judge Hastie.
Who was Judge Hastie?
He's a judge in New York City. And Judge Dorothy Kenyon is on here.
She was? She was what?
She's a judge in New York City, a federal judge. Dr. Frank Kingdon is a prominent congregational minister. Oscar Lange, Prime Minister of Poland later. Max Lerner of the...
Of the what?
He's Max Lerner of the New York Post for one,
yeah.
And also
quite a few things.
Yeah, yeah. Mrs. Edward G. Robinson's on here, I see, and Edward Robinson, and Paul Robeson.
Yes, of course, I know Paul. Well, I've mentioned a few of those names in my writing so far as samples.
Mm-hmm.
Of the widespread group, but I thought I would take tape from you as to a few more, and this is wonderful. I may use some of this, you know.
I suppose Governor Gifford Pinchot is the most prominent of all on here.
Yes. Well, probably was at that time.
Yeah, and Robert C. Weaver is now
Remember, I don't think Elmer Benson belonged on there.
Robert Weaver's on here. I see now a member of the President's Cabinet. Say, whatever happened to R.J. Thomas? I notice he's on here.
Yeah, now about the state campaign in 44. What part did you take in it?
Well, not a great deal, I guess, but it seems to me we had a citizens' committee for Barney Allen. It seems to me we did. Wasn't that when Barney Allen was there? And, of course, in the national campaign, we had an active committee.
Did you personally do any campaigning?
No.
Did you make any speeches?
I don't think so. I may have made a radio speech, but I don't think I made any speeches.
This was the first time that you had a personal campaign. And you actually took very little part, although you did speak for a rally or two and a couple of times for the president. I don't think it.
And I... That's the
that's year. Pretty safe guess.
That's the year I did. I think I told you about that at the time I did give Governor Moses of North Dakota $5,000 for his campaign. Did I tell you about that?
I don't think so. No.
Well, that is a rather interesting story. I was in New York.
Governor Moses.
Of North Dakota.
He was up for
re-election. No, he was up for the United States Senate.
Oh, yeah.
And the people in New York had been supporting the National Commander of the American Legion from Fargo. I think his name was Stanbaugh. He later was appointed to some federal job and still has it in Washington. But anyway, back in New York, I complained to Coleman and Pinchot and others about supporting this man. They said, well, they weren't supporting him. And then they called in others and they said they weren't supporting, but some fellow over in the Waldorf Towers was giving him a lot of money. Well, Hillman said, well, who do you support? Well, I said, you should support Governor Moses. And we ended by his saying to me, well, we can't, for some legal reason at that time, technical reason, the Seattle PAC could not contribute to his campaign. But if I would contribute $5,000 to Moses' campaign, he'd see that I was repaid. So I did. When I got back to Minneapolis, I called Governor Moses and asked him, told him that I had $5,000 that I could contribute to his campaign, and what did he want me to do with it? And he says, send it to me. I was surprised at that. I know I never would have accepted it in other circumstances. I thought he'd have me sent to...
You never did accept money directly.
Never. But anyway, I did send him a check for $5,000, and he was elected. And then before he took office, he died. And then before I got my money back, Sidney Hillman died. But I got every dollar of it back. Arrangements had been made beforehand, and the money came into me. In fact, I got $1,000 more than I had advanced.
How come?
Well, I suppose just air and bookkeeping, I suppose.
What'd you do with it?
Well, next time I went to New York, I went in to see Telford Dudley, who was then the secretary of Seattle PAC. I told him I got $1,000 more than I was entitled to. And he says, you got more than that, didn't you? Well, needless to say, that made me pretty damn mad. To suggest that I got more than $1,000 when I had told him that I got $1,000. So I paid him $1,000 back, and that was the end of it.
And you paid him $1,000 back. Yeah. That was the end of it.
Yeah. I think it's rather unusual. Usually you don't come out that well in money you've advanced in a political campaign, especially when both
principles are dead.
Say, Elmer, this is another question, just while I think about it. Occurs to me, in selling your, in liquidating your land holdings, you know, over these years, which you did apparently very profitably.
Yes.
Were your sales or your disposition of them ever to corporations?
No, no.
No corporation farmers?
No, no.
They were all individual farmers?
Small.
Were some of them turned over to people who you thought were speculating?
Not that I know of, not that I recall.
If you had suspected that, what would you have done?
Well, I suppose...
You'd have sold if you'd have gotten a good profit.
I suppose, sure.
But you certainly, but you didn't sell to any corporation farmers?
No.
I think it's important.
They were all small, mostly small tracts. I think the largest tract I think we sold was to, I owned the Herd Ranch at Berkshire, North Dakota. That is my own, I've forgotten how many acres that was. Sold that to the farmer that was farming it and his brother who was a professor at the University of North Dakota. And then we sold a tract of land to a man in Montana who, Kramer's name was. He operated the largest rodeo in the world. Traveled all over the country with his rodeo. And he, it was just a bare piece of land when we sold it to him, but he built it up into a regular show place.
Range area.
Yeah. Range land, yeah.
Now in Denver, you had a big meeting at which the governor was present. Sure. I don't remember his name, do you?
No, I don't recall his name.
Well, Orville Olson told me this interesting yarn, that there was some guy at the meeting or at the banquet or whatever it was.
I think it was a banquet.
Who had a little too much to drink. And he kept needling you with questions about Stassen. And to Orville and Beanie's horror, you got all worked up and just kept on talking about Stassen and this guy's questions, rather than about the most things you were important. Do you remember anything about
that? No, I don't. I don't remember that.
Well, I just thought, If there was a story in it, I'd like to hear it.
No, I don't remember that.
Now, on this California business, what's this about Manchester Bodie?
Well, he was talked of as a candidate for the United States Senator, but I remember it, a lot of people thought he was really, truly a remarkable person, but that he was so interested in his beautiful gardens that... he could forget all about the campaign or an election and spend his time in his garden.
What about Manchester Bodie? I mean, Colonel Evans Carlson. Who was he, by the way?
He was a retired colonel in the United States from the United States Marines. A real progressive. He's passed away.
And did you meet with Orson Welles in the group?
Yes.
You had several fine meetings.
With Orson Welles, yes.
Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, you raised quite a lot of money at the Hollywood group.
That's right.
Do you remember anything else particularly about that visit?
No, but you mentioned San Francisco or being there.
Yeah.
I've forgotten just who the character was, but there was some person in San Francisco that we got pretty disgusted with. I suppose Beanie would probably know.
Beanie already told me. It was a meeting of the big meeting of labor people.
Yeah.
And
we had one fellow pegged as being a bad guy.
And you called him that in public.
Yeah.
You called him a phony right out in the group.
And he
was shocked.
But later he turned out to be that.
Hey, he turned out. This was a big meeting that you labor people.
I forgot who he was.
I have his name. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know about it. Oh, he came he was out. Head, he was head of the architects, engineers, and something or other.
Turned out to be a real phony.
Yeah.
And he proved it. I mean, during our discussions, you know, he proved it himself to me. I thought he did.
Do you remember the details?
No, I don't.
But you apparently took him on and called him a phony,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
Right in the discussion.
Sure, I think so.
About Einar Højdahl, you were talking. He was the chairman of that meeting in 45, with, in your honor. Go ahead.
Yes, well, way back when... when there was some doubt as to whether or not President Wilson had been elected or Hughes had been elected President of the United States, it was thought that Minnesota was going to decide the election. That was before we had the fine communication that we now have in radio. And Einar Højdahl at that time was a candidate for the United States Senate against Tom Shaw. It was thought that Einar Højdahl was elected.
This must have been in 1916. Yeah.
And Einar Højdahl went on the radio thanking the people of Minnesota for his election to the United States Senate. Well, when the vote from the Iron Range came in, Einar Højdahl was defeated. And it wasn't important whether or not Minnesota went for Wilson or not, because California had decided the election for Wilson.
Einar was running as a Democrat?
Democrat for the United States Senate.
Yeah.
But they no doubt stole the election from Einar Højdahl on the range. And perhaps I've told you...
What did he do during your times, your administration?
Well, I think he was, he was always friendly. He was.
He was a Democrat.
He was a Democrat, always a Democrat, yes. I think I've told you earlier about that same election.
Where did he live?
Minneapolis.
All right.
He was a congressman from Minneapolis for a while. But anyway, one time I was coming back from, on the train from Washington, and I was... Senator Joe Guffey of Pennsylvania came through the train and saw me sitting there, and he said, "Hey, Senator," he said, "we've got..."
This is while you were in the Senate?
Yes. "We've got a private car on the back end of the train. A lot of your friends are there. We're going to the Kentucky Derby. Why don't you come back with us?" "No," I said, I want to read a little while, then I'm going to bed."
This was on the way from Washington to Chicago.
Yeah. So he sat down and talked for a while, and he said, "Do you remember the election when Hughes was running against Wilson and Minnesota was in doubt and they thought Minnesota was going to decide the election?" I says, "Yes, I remember it very well." Well, he said, "At that time, I got a telephone call, and the man says, 'Joe, do you know who this is speaking?'" And I said, "Yes, I do." I hadn't heard from him since we were in law school together. But his father was a coal miner, and my father was a coal miner, and we went to high school together, and we went to law school together. When he got through school, he went to work for the United States Steel Corporation, and I went into private practice. And I hadn't heard from him in all these years, but I knew his voice. Well, he said, "Joe, they're going to steal the election from you up on the Iron Range in Minnesota."
May I ask who he's talking about, or are you coming to that?
No, he didn't tell me who it was.
Go ahead.
Just a boyhood friend of his. So he says, "If you want to do anything about it, you better get busy." Well, Guffey says, we immediately telephoned to Minnesota, and then we sent two men up there from Pittsburgh. And then, of course, he says the returns from California came in, so we dropped it. We didn't do any more about it. But I'm pretty sure that's where they stole the election from Einar Højdahl, too.
We were just talking, Elmer, about your attitude towards the war after the invasion of Russia and before Pearl Harbor, and I gather that your opinion changed quite a bit.
Yes, it did.
You and Roger talked this over, you say?
Yes, we talked it over many times, and my opinion about the war changed, of course, definitely changed at the time of the invasion of the Soviet Union. It had to change. I mean, that.
You were quoted once shortly after that as saying it's still a phony war.
Yes, I couldn't make up my mind instantly, of course. And I remember there was a American Legion National Convention being held, and there was naturally a discussion of the war at that convention. And I gave some consideration at that time to sending a telegram urging them to go on record supporting a second front by the United States. But I didn't do it.
In other words, urging that the United States enter the war.
Yeah.
That was well before, that was sometime in the fall.
I suppose September, October perhaps, September. I don't remember when the committee leaked.
You talked this over with Roger?
Yeah, we talked about it several times.
And you decided that it would be unwise to go that far.
That's right. I don't think they made up their mind on what side they were going to fight.
In other words, your feeling, even now, is that World War II was, as you put it, a phony war, until the invasion of Russia.
Yeah, I certainly did, yeah. You know. And I still think that.
down in Chicago, in I guess this was 46 or 47, 46 I think, the big meeting, you attacked both Murray and Ickes.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, it started with the. It started with the main meeting. Phil Murray talked, and Ickes talked, and Morgenthau talked. Phil Murray's speech was so bad, I know I left the platform. I didn't want to sit there with him. And Ickes was almost as bad.
In what respect?
I've forgotten the nature. They were frightened. They were frightened. They were. I've forgotten just the nature of their attack, but it was actually an attack on liberals.
There was a program being prepared.
Yeah.
And they were against the program.
I just don't remember exactly what the nature of their speeches.
Well, I can check. I have some documents.
Were very bad, and then Morgenthau came on with his speech, which was excellent. Here, a multimillionaire ex-secretary of the Treasury was making a much finer speech than either Ickes or Phil Murray. So, at the committee meeting at noon, at lunch. Phil was in the chair, his chairman, and they both. And then I remember Louis Adamek got up and criticized both Phil and
Harold.
Then Florence Eldridge, Frederick March's wife, got up and criticized them. And all the time I was just boiling. I thought to myself, my gosh, if this writer, Louis Adamek, and this actor or actress, if they can attack and expose Phil and Harold, I certainly can't sit here.
What am I sitting here for?
So I did. I attacked him pretty severely. Well, following that, The next morning we had breakfast with Phil. I don't know, about a dozen of us, I guess. And then I was delegated to talk to Phil alone after that.
That's when you went up to his room.
That's, yeah.
And he strutted back and forth.
That's right.
You told me about that.
Yeah.
Well, that's good to hear.
At that time, I remember Florence Eldridge said that she was in Paris at the time of the Nazi invasion. And she said she told how the many of the liberals caved in, which actually gave support to the Nazis, really, even though they didn't do so directly. But indirectly, it gave support to the Nazis. And she likened Phil Murray's and Ecce's talk to that situation.
Renaissance,
yeah.
During that time, a revival of learning through the WPA.
Yeah,
I have mentioned.
I think we should show the excitement of that period.
Yes.
That was 2 years. That was 4 years before we lost power to Stassen.
Yeah.
And then that was the shutdown of
that
everything.
Time of learning and a time of excitement and a time of getting together.
Yeah.
And I think I was very fortunate in not only going in the Socialist Party was my time of learning economics, really.
Uh-huh.
It is for the first time I learned how capitalism works and the difference between socialism and capitalism. I learned why there was unemployment. I think that was the main thing, all this unemployment with work that should be done. I made up my mind I was going to learn why. And
yeah.
I did.
That's good.
There had been no real occasion before that in Dakota. What we talked about most was injustice to the farmer and why they stole from him his dockage and everything else that they could, you know, legally. And so during this time, I went to all sorts of meetings. Oscar did. Everybody else did.
Yeah.
Too.
Oh, it was great.
We all did. And the first part of it was learning, and then there was doing.
That's good.
And agitation. And doing something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we thought we could do something about it. And to a certain extent, we did. And then there came the, not disillusionment, I wouldn't call it that, because all of that was to the good. And in the coming and going of the centuries and the ages, it was a step forward, a step towards the uniting of the people. And you never go completely back. You may have a setback, but you don't go back.
Mm. And it was the rising of the classes. You really had there the working class and the farmers,
yes,
who really were, yes, participating in government.
And when it came towards the loss of power and they taking power, well, I felt as though that movement, and this is what I said in Marion's obituary, I think I found that somewhere, the scrap paper notes. It's not in your book, the way I said. That is, every movement encompasses something, accomplishes something, and then dies. But it gives way to a greater movement. And that's what was happening at that time. We had this movement of reform and it was beginning to give way to a sharper conflict, the McCarthy days, the class conflict, the big war. And now we have still a greater movement. Now we have the Negroes and the revolutionary movement. That's the way I feel about it.
In the world. And a world, world movement.
A world movement.
Yeah.
So.
Now you see, this is what I envisage your book is about. Just what you just, if we can bring that out. So the young people can see that here's a woman who lived through all of this period, and then came to this, see the world struggle. This is my idea of a book about you should be. If we can, see, that's what I've been aiming at getting.
That's the truth. That's the way
it is.
Yeah,
that's right.
It's like the coming and going of the life through the centuries. And that change in the great movement from reform on through to revolution and a change in the system.
It's also the people that we, like all the teachers and the reformers and like yourself, that I wanted to bring out in all these people who lay the foundation and keep alive this, you know, through the bad periods, the good periods. I think this should be... you're important because you were one of those of thousands who kept this alive, you know, and taught and learned, and even in the bad times, like the when we get to the McCarthy period, you show how there was people who kept alive and fearless during that period, like yourself and others. They were fearless and they really took a beating, but they kept alive the freedom. And don't you think this is the reason that people would want to read your book, you know, in the next generation?
I know, and it must have something in it.
This is my idea of the whole thing, to show
that,
you came up in this whole social struggle.
History, struggle, and the people, those people. And that from the very beginning. The Irish that I grew up with were a part of the struggle, too.
Mm-hmm. You learned from them, too.
And I certainly learned from them. Didn't I learn from Andy Devitt?
Mm-hmm.
Frank Strong. And those. They were nonpartisan league people. Mm-hmm. They are the first generation.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the nonpartisan league didn't come until much later, but they were the one. They were still living all the...
Well, it wouldn't have come without them.
Huh?
The Nonpartisan League wouldn't have been without these teachers.
No, it wouldn't have.
Like Devitt and Strong and Arthur Lothur. I mean, they taught since 1900.
Yes.
In every village in the Dakotas. I think that's important for the young to understand, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is the teaching and the... every flower has a root. You know, every plant has a root. It just doesn't... They have roots.
I have lived through the roots of all this movement.
Mm-hmm. And that's what we want to show in this book, mm-hmm. you know, how we are the roots. And we came from other roots.
Yes.
Yeah, I that's my idea. The reason that I'm interested in the book is I think the young people mm-hmm. don't have this.
It's got to be a book that will have a purpose so young people will read it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
That's what I've thought.
And this is, you just expressed, I think, right now, what we should keep in mind to show your growth, you know, with others into this, and, you know, how you kept on. Nothing stopped you. You know, there was lots of setbacks, and even some people who ceased to believe in it.
Well...
I mean, the people who really came through a whole lifetime of belief, you know, really, you don't keep that for, you have to struggle for it.
When I think of those struggles, that should come now too, there are so many people say, well, what good was all that? You know, kind of discouraged because we hadn't reached the goal. But you are... your goal, your ultimate goal, of course, has to be far away, maybe. But you are reaching a goal every day in reform. Some people don't believe in reform. They believe in revolution. I don't know. I can't see it. I think it takes time to be ripe for revolution, maybe. I don't know. It seems to me it does. Anyway, that's what we did. We worked hard for reform. We had tremendous opposition. But we got it. We got a better life for the people. And I don't know whether I've said this before or not. We're called communists. The DFL, that group around Humphrey, Naphthalene and the rest of them over there, practically in every convention they've had since the merger, they have boasted how they got rid of the communists. And at the same time, they are benefiting by everything that we farmer laborites did. If that is communism, well, let it be communism. It isn't, it's only reform. But they benefit by all the reforms that we had. And that was Social Security. Of course, they've added to it. When the bourgeois class found out that they kind of liked Social Security, they proceeded to get some of it for themselves. That is it. It was working people at first, but they found out that they wanted it.
Mm-hmm. They could
get it. And now they're doing it for themselves. And bank insurance, they certainly are enjoying that. Home loan, how many didn't save their homes for their home loan, including Oscar and I?
And including the very wealthy.
Huh?
Including the very wealthy also. The very rich.
The very wealthy. Yes. Mary Murphy was a social worker. And during that deep depression, I remember especially one family that she told about. There was the mother, the daughter, and an uncle. The mother couldn't do very much. The daughter, but they didn't have money, and they couldn't sell their stuff. So there they sat in the cold with shawls over them. They just couldn't do anything. The only one that they couldn't even cook, except the uncle. He did the cooking. Mm. Mary told that story.
Well, you remember how many of the rich killed themselves. Suicides,
yes,
in the,
yes,
30s was,
they just couldn't
jumped
meet,
out of the windows.
They couldn't meet life. They didn't know how to live. They didn't know how to do. And I think of another couple that got themselves a grinder of some kind, and they had a sack of wheat. And that's what they lived on.